Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Patrick Cotter, Amisha Cross, T.O. Hardiman, and Stephanie Hitt. Our program tonight coming to you from home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo, @DUMO. And you can join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com. That's the audio and video live portion of the show each and every week. There are 8 days to go before the Republican convention in Cleveland. I'll be there next Sunday night, 120 days to go before Election Day. And we have lots to discuss this evening, both hours talking about the politics, but the bigger issues that certainly have dominated the news, and that is the police shootings and the assassination of five Dallas police officers. We will discuss that at length. Your input at 1-800-723-8289 is very important tonight. And I want to begin with you, Amisha Cross. I don't see this necessarily tonight, by the way, as a liberal, conservative, Republican, Democratic issue. We're talking about an issue of race relations. We're talking about what happened in Dallas. And let me ask you, as an African-American, you come from a police family. What's the big takeaway for you as to what happened in Dallas and what happened in Baton Rouge and in Minnesota last week?
First off, I kind of want to separate Baton Rouge and Minnesota because I feel as though those were incidences that we've seen across the country. Some have gotten major media attention, some haven't, where police use excessive use of force. It is something that African Americans, specifically African American males, have faced since the 1800s. That's not new to us at all. Being able to literally see video in one case of this happening live at the time was something I think that shocked the nation. And it's something that I believe will move people in one way or the other to try to make some decisions. When we're looking at the incident in Dallas, that to me is completely sometimes even hard to explain. I have three cousins who serve on the Dallas Police Force and who were actually there on that night. And it's very hard because on the one hand, Dallas is one of the most forward moving and forward thinking police departments in the country, with 54% of their police department being minorities. They are a police department that has worked conciliatory with the community for close to 5 to 7 years at this
point. So it is exemplary when you compare it to many other large city police departments in the United States.
Exactly.
T.O. Hardiman, I want to get you to weigh in on that. What do you think is the takeaway from all of the actions of last week?
Well, first and foremost, my heart goes out and my prayers to the families of the five officers that were killed in Dallas and also the families of the young men that were killed by the police. The reality in America, what people need to understand, there's no data to back up the fact that African-American young men are a threat to police nationwide. And there's a systematic problem with the system which causes some police officers to cross the line and continue to kill African-American males in particular. So my takeaway is that the nation as a whole should work on a healing process, and we should petition the President of the United States and the Department of Justice to do a better job at making sure we bring this issue of excessive force to an end once and for all.
One follow-up to you. Are you disappointed that after 7 years of Barack Obama as president, that race relations don't seem to be any better than where they are right now?
No, I cannot blame our president for everything. What I'm saying is this issue of excessive force has not been dealt with effectively, and everybody plays a role. I'm talking about police jurisdictions in the different cities, different states. We need to work harder to bridge the gap.
Patrick Cotter joins us. He's a former federal prosecutor from Brooklyn, New York, and now a defense attorney in Chicago. Patrick, what's your overview of all the actions that took place involving police officers last week?
Well, I think to echo some of the comments we've already heard tonight, it is no secret to anybody who works in the criminal justice system that there has always been a problem with police forces and minorities. And that's just a reality. I was a federal prosecutor, but before that I was a public defender in Brooklyn for 5 years. And that's an education. If you don't grow up in the poor neighborhoods of our urban cities, if you have to go in and learn what people are going through and the way the police relate to them. I respect the police, and I think they have a terribly hard job to do, but there has always been a problem with how police forces relate to minorities, and they just treat them differently. and there's no question about it. Anybody knows it. Now everybody knows it because we're seeing video of it. So unfortunately, my takeaway from last week, except for the Dallas incident, is that tragically it's just another week. It's more of the same.
Stephanie Hitt, our Republican tonight. Stephanie?
You know, I think, especially as a mother of teenage boys, and albeit white, I realize, and I think it's really come home to a lot of people, and we've heard it from all sorts of people, that African-American teenage males have a real, they have a real bias against them. And there's no doubt that we have all learned that they can be treated differently. I think we also learned also that there are some bad people everywhere. And when you have an organization of a million, you know, law enforcement officers across the country, sadly, we keep seeing the really bad ones. There are just bad people.
But do we know, in this particular case, do we know, insofar as those that the police officers involved in the shooting in Louisiana, do we know that they were racist? I don't think we know that. We know that they may have been poorly trained. We may know that they overreacted. What words would you put on? And we want to separate them. To me, the most egregious one is what happened in Minnesota. What's your view of that? I want to see if you and I have the same view.
It would depend on your level of egregious, because if you're talking to the mom or the siblings or the kids of the two men who got shot in other areas who were not police officers, I think that you would hear something entirely different. They have families as well, and they have a legacy that they left behind. In terms of sheer mass and amount, of course you're going to feel something different for when there are more people shot in an area than when there are fewer. But I would argue that from an African-American perspective and watching this continually happen, for me, it's not Alton Sterling got shot, and then 2, 3, 4 years later, you'll hear about it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. In all honesty, it happens nearly every hour on the hour in this country somewhere. So again, like that is my issue. The entirety of America can get around, and I can't argue against that. Get around and support what happened in Dallas, support the people who lost individuals, but they cannot.
Is there something
when it comes to these African American men?
When an African American gets shot, granted, there needs to be investigation. There has to be maybe greater sensitivity. I think I certainly would agree with that. But when an African American is stopped for anything by any police officer anywhere, should the first thing they do is to raise their hands? Literally, raise their hands before they're asked to raise their hand. Is that too much to ask?
Well, let the truth be told, Bruce, there appears to be an unwritten rule with some officers that continue to look at African-American youth as a threat. Okay, the thing is, if you're not equipped or comfortable enough in dealing with African-American males, you don't need to be a police officer. The reality is I already recommended something to the Chicago Police Department.
Do you believe that certain African-American young men want to be a threat? They talk like a threat. They look like a threat. They want to be a threat. They want to be intimidated.
No, not
you
at all. No,
that.
No kind of way. Our people out here, these are our young brothers and sisters out here that walking around in the community. They're everyday people. Everyday people. Bottom line. They do not want to be a threat.
You don't think many of them look like people who have created problems?
If that's the case, a lot of people look like that. Not just African American men.
Let's talk a little bit more about it.
That's right.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Dumont back in Chicago. During the break, we had a heated conversation that broke out. Amisha, make the point you were going to make that Patrick disagrees with.
So my main point is that there isn't a specific set of rules that African-American males, young African-American males, can follow to prevent police brutality. I just don't think that that's true. I have a lot of friends who are college-educated, who are extremely polite, who have not been stopped by police officers and have had to deal with some egregious behavior, even though they have absolutely no criminal records. So the argument that, okay, well, certain black men are acting in a way that would, I guess, enforce cops to react the way that they are, it's just untrue.
What about my point? By the way, maybe this isn't just – if you're stopped by the police, everybody raise your hand. Everybody raise your hand. Let everybody be compliant. Let everybody be compliant until we find out there is evidence, which now could be recorded on video cam, that you have somehow, by raising your hand and being compliant, you're still getting either shot or beaten up.
Because it doesn't work. There was a case in Louisiana literally this morning where a guy ended up getting shot, and it was caught on videotape at the gas station he was at by a police officer who said that he had pulled a gun on him. According to this videotape, which was filmed live, man never had a gun, got out, put his hands up, still got shot.
Patrick, you had a comment.
Yeah, first of all, I'm not suggesting that there's some magic steps you can take and you won't have any problems. What I'm suggesting is that there are things you can do in every human interaction, particularly with the police, to either exacerbate it or make it better. It improves the chances of a good outcome. There's things the police can do to make a better outcome. There's things civilians can do. And I'm simply making the point that it is not necessarily the case that every time somebody tries to act in a way that limits the chances of things going wrong, that it doesn't work. The fact of the matter is you don't hear about those. There are thousands of stops every day in this country. Most of them end peacefully. The ones you hear about are where it goes wrong. So you can't
if
you would let me finish, then you'll know what I'm doing. What I'm doing is saying I am not saying that it's somehow the victim's fault. What I'm saying is if we're talking about doing something constructive as opposed to all of us sitting around saying this is terrible, which we all agree, and we've all been saying it forever. What I'm saying is we've got to teach police how to de-escalate situations. But people also have to know how to de-escalate situations. That's my only point.
No, I agree with that. What I was saying was there's a level of codifying behavior with the conversation we just had to where if you act a certain way, the response will not be as egregious. And what I'm telling you is that at the end of the day, for an African-American male walking in an African-American black body in this country today, by sheer view of their race, they are considered a threat regardless of how they respond.
Yeah,
what's
disagreeing
with that?
Yeah. I just want to add. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, we actually had a very public example of that a few years ago. James Blake, who is a professional tennis player, Harvard graduate, was standing outside a hotel room during the U.S. Open, and there happened to have been a black suspect running through, and the police ended up knocking him down. He was in front of an expensive hotel, wearing nice clothes, got knocked down on the ground. They forced him down to the ground, and, you know, he did the, hey, you know, didn't argue, did all the things that we tell our kids to do. If something happens to you, you don't fight back. You're polite. You're nice. And as it turns out, it ended fairly calmly and peacefully or whatever. We all agree. Unfortunately, the sad thing is that he matched the description of a suspect, and that automatically put him in harm's way.
Well, I would like to just say there's a preponderance of evidence that dictates that we've had a 100-year code of silence even here in Chicago. So African-American people in general have been under the gun for a long time. It's not just because they get shot. What about all the wrongful incarcerations, okay? You have a mayor right now in Chicago that covered up the execution of Laquan McDonald, who was shot 16 times
by
police.
Would you account, by the way, the code of silence for police officers is part of the problem?
It's a major part of it.
Would you also acknowledge to you that the code of silence that exists in the black community, that they never see anything, they don't give any tips, nobody ever gets charged, very rarely do they get charged with the volumes of crime that take place in the black communities of Chicago. Would you acknowledge that that code of silence or that intimidation, it exists in all neighborhoods?
Well, it exists, you know, throughout the African-American community. But let me say this. I'll go on the record and say this. The police will never be able to stop killings in the African-American community. That's something that African-American men have to do. I just have to be straight up with you.
Why haven't they done it?
Well, because there's too much division in the community right now. The code of silence is a problem, without a doubt, but there's a lot of division as well. But on the solution side...
Over what?
Division. There's just different trains of thought. It's all a bunch of BS, Bruce, being honest with you. My people need to step up, quit being cowards, and address the epidemic of violence in their own community and work with one another. I'm talking about family members need to work with their relatives that are involved in the violence and let them know you're not going to be a part of this family.
Should they turn their relatives in if their relatives are responsible for killing someone?
Well, I'm not going to really comment on that right now, to be honest with you, because we have to fix this broken system first. We have a broken system here in America, and a lot of people just don't have faith in the system. Right now in Chicago,
so if
Bruce.
I want to just follow that. Yeah. So if you live in a neighborhood and you know that your next door neighbor or even a kin of yours was involved in murdering another human being, you don't think there's any responsibility to turn that person into police?
I have a good answer for you. I would step to my relative and make sure they don't kill nobody. Because, see, the work that I do as a violence prevention specialist, we stop people from crossing the line. And so, therefore, nobody goes to jail and nobody goes to the cemetery. It's up to the individuals if they want to turn people in. That's up to them. I just want to make that clear. Because the reality of it is that we have a broken system here. I would never condone killings, okay? I don't condone nobody killing nobody. But people need to do what they feel is best for them.
Patrick, do you also think that getting into this code of silence that really, at this particular time, since everyone has, virtually everybody has one of these cell phones that they can take pictures and they can see the good and bad conduct of police officers, what we're talking about tonight is the news that gets on the air that somebody has shot a video after someone has been shot or killed. Do police officers have to start thinking smartly about their conduct and believing that virtually everything they do may be on videotape?
Yes. I think police officers for too long have believed the exact opposite. They have believed that they can do whatever they want and that all the other officers involved will back them up no matter what they do.
Right.
Because that's their code of silence. And it's worked. It's worked for them for decades. And what's happened now is that the videos make it harder, not impossible, but harder to do that. And I would say that any police officer would be foolish nowadays to think that just because, assuming that they can count on their brother officers, brother and sister officers to back them up, that they're going to be fine because of video. That's what's changed.
Right. I think one other thing I want to get to you, but one other point, this is a caution I would, or a suggestion I would give to my colleagues in the media. Whenever we have an incident like this, when everybody talks about the need for a discussion of race relations, and I firmly believe that, if you're a longtime listener to this show, we've done probably more shows on this discussion than any national radio show in the country, okay? We've done it a long time, and we'll continue to do it. But I'll tell you one thing. If you're a member of the media and you want to have a dialogue about what's good and bad about police and what's good and bad about those that challenge the police, don't ever have a member of a police union as a spokesman to discuss that. They're union organizers. They will acknowledge no wrongdoing by police officers, and that is wrong. Every police officer who's listening to this show tonight probably knows some cop who they work with who does a lousy job and is an embarrassment to their police department. And I think everybody would be honest if they said that. But, you know, you get a union guy, and I saw that was on a couple of the shows today. They had union reps on, and, boy, they couldn't see anything that any police officer could ever do wrong. And obviously this was in the context of obviously the tragedy that took place in Dallas, which is it's related, but it's somewhat different.
Well,
Stephanie.
And it's interesting you talk about the power of video. And again, there are a lot of police departments that have taken on putting on the body cams. And many police officers have welcomed that because, in fact, it does show from start to end, from the initial contact with a suspect or whatever, what goes on. So that it's a little
bit
harder.
Unless they disengage it.
Well, and it gets a little bit harder to take, you know, things out of context. And so, I mean, I guess that's what we've come to now as a society is we're now videotaping everything with each other and...
I have a solution for the police department if they're watching, okay? The police department should film a public service announcement which clearly shows what constitutes the use of deadly force and get somebody like Samuel L. Jackson to deliver that message. I mean, three different scenarios. This is what leads to deadly force. I think it can go a long way, Bruce.
That before you did that, because that obviously implies a horrible end to the confrontation.
Yes.
How about something simple like what happens if the police stop you on the street for everybody?
Right, a PSA,
everybody.
Like, okay,
you
this,
do?
You know, like stop, drop, and roll for the fire department. You
that
do something similar,
What about that?
No, they need to do a straightforward PSA that exposes what constitutes the use of deadly force. The reason why, because deadly force is a big topic right now across America.
But no, you're not putting any responsibility on the person who allegedly may have done something. You're putting all of the stress on the police officer.
No, I'm just saying merely just film a PSA. I'm just saying educate the public. I mean, put it in layman's terms where, look, this is what happens. If I catch you running with a gun, I have the ability to shoot and kill you if I decide to. I can use my discretion, but law dictates that I can shoot you if you're running down the street with a gun.
Is that a good idea, Patrick?
I don't think it's a bad idea, but I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I mean, I think the key is to look at other countries and how their police operate. And in a lot of countries, they spend a lot more time in training on de-escalation. And we don't in this country.
Okay.
We train our police officers to enforce the law, to get guys and freeze the situation. They are taught to control. And in other countries, they're told to de-escalate. You're always going to have violence in crime. You're always going to have violence in law enforcement. It's a violent world, and they're dealing with violent issues on both sides. But you could train people in de-escalation, and I think that education is something practical we can do to try and begin to address this issue. It's not going to address every issue. There's always going to be bad cops. There's always going to be bad guys. There's bad guys out there. Yeah. But, one was in Dallas. I mean, the point is that there are things we really could be doing if we were serious, and we could be training our police to de-escalate. We could frankly test our police better. We don't do any psychological testing in most police departments before you hire people. And that seems to be a huge gap.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border around the world on beyondthebeltway.com. I'm Bruce Dumont, back from Chicago with your calls in a few moments.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Amisha, I want to come back to you. You were making a point during the break about the breakdown in the American family and how that is an integral part of what we're talking about tonight.
Right. So if we're talking about violence reduction in the African-American community specifically, part of the argument always and will always go back to the family and the erosion of that with African-American males not being in the home. There is a very valid argument that if African-American males were to organize around the community, were to be able to show to young black men that there was another way out, then you would definitely see things change within that community. But I honestly think it would be very difficult at this point in society when 7 in 10 African-American families have no male leader in the household.
Let me make a point and tell me whether there's a correlation here. Because of the lack of authority figure in black homes, and it isn't exclusively black homes. It could be poor class or right. Poor white kids as well. But because of a lack of authority figure, there is no respect for authority. And the first authority that many black men run into, and even white men, is the police officer. So they're not used to authority figures. They're not used to anyone telling them no in a strong, demonstrative way. Is there some truth? Is there a grain of truth to that, Teal?
There's a little bit of truth to it, Bruce. But you got to understand the position of us being African American people. Let me make this clear. You have 100 years, once again, of abuse in our community. I'm going all the way back to when they used to sick dogs on our people. Our visions of the police are already distorted. I'm not saying our police are bad. I want to make that clear. But our visions are distorted because of the history of the police here. You got corruption going on within the police department. All police are not bad. I want to make that clear. But at the same time, we just have a bad taste in our mouths to a degree with our history with the police department.
But again, okay? does then what level of respect is there for the policeman?
To be honest with you, there's a lot of respect for the police in the African American community. People just don't talk about it.
Why don't they talk about it?
They don't want to talk about it because it's better in the media to make this get this perception that people are against the police. But the majority of African-American people are law-abiding citizens. Most of the people you see on the news, as far as an African-American community, the guys that, you know, cross the line and break the law, they hype them up in the media. They don't hype up the fact that a lot of African-American men are graduating from college. They don't hype up the fact that you got some good families out here doing the best they can, families that are being led by mothers, grandmothers, raising their kids, doing the best they can.
Do they acknowledge, when I say the African-American community, if we went into the south and west sides of Chicago tonight,
yes,
would we easily find people that would say that? And would they also say that thank God for the police department, because the police department makes my life is not easy. They try to make my life a little bit easier. Would they say that, or would they say, no, we're being occupied by a police department that is primarily white, but in Chicago it's not totally white?
I would definitely say that, and I come from a police family background. I would say that as an African American living on the south side of Chicago, you would be hard pressed to find somebody who said the police made their lives better. And I say that because even if you're not involved in a criminal activity yourself and you're reporting it for somebody else. I had a friend who actually called 911 to report a man who was threatening a woman. He had a weapon on him. It was a domestic violence situation. The police said that unless that person actually got shot, they could not call them back. So no, there is no the level of respect there, the level of understanding that they are here to protect us in minority communities in Chicago, and I would probably say around the country, is probably not there. Just because when something bad happens, they are really late to show up. In addition to that, in certain communities, you might not see them at all. The relationship, that relationship strength that is necessary in order to build community and build that respect, just has not been there.
Would you also acknowledge, as we discussed earlier in the broadcast, that there's many who live in those communities that literally don't provide much information to the crime that happens in their communities? I mean, as you know, every single night in Chicago, virtually every night, the lead story, maybe the first two or three stories, is about someone being shot or killed in this city. And yet you don't see those cases solved. Is there a lack of engagement, the lack of concern within the African American communities to solve crimes when their neighbor may have been killed? Or their
I don't
son
think there's a lack
killed.
Of engagement and concern. Having a father who's a police chief and used to lead a narcotics department, part of that issue in terms of the reluctancy in and of itself is one of retaliation. There are a lot of African Americans who aren't going to call the police, knowing that certain things are happening, because gang member down the street knows who they are. Because it's very hard to protect them after that's done. There's a very different dichotomy of situation there.
Pat, can you comment on that? Do you have any input on that? I mean,
I think the intimidation
factor, because there is a level of, and I'm going to use the word, there's a level of terrorism that exists in all major urban areas. People are terrified in their homes, terrified maybe to call or say something that they see, because they're fearful that they're going to be shot or their kids are going to be shot.
Yeah, I know a little bit about witness intimidation. I prosecuted the mafia for eight years.
By the way, for those that don't know, you're the guy who led the investigation in the prosecution of John Gotti, the head of the crime family in Brooklyn. And so you've gone after big people who like to kill people who go after them. And you're here to tell the story.
First of all, I was part of a team.
Yes.
And I'm a very proud member of that team, but I it was not a one-person thing in any stretch of the imagination.
Elliot Ness.
No, I'm a little too short. The point is that I think I have dealt with investigating murders where there were hundreds of witnesses and nobody would come forward. And it was very hard. And one thought I have on this issue, and it's something I've talked about for a while, is I think, for instance, at a place like Chicago on the South and West Side, the government has to treat that just as seriously as they treat the mafia. And there should be a strike force on shootings and gang shootings in Chicago. We should have dedicated investigators and dedicated federal prosecutors going in there and creating the structure that allows people to feel that I can talk and live. We had the witness protection program. I could guarantee people that they and their families would live if they would cooperate. It wasn't easy, but it worked. And the point is we as a society have to elevate the priority of protecting these people's lives. You are, I agree with you completely. This is a community that has been taken over by criminals, and they are frightening the honest people, and they're making them at least be silent, and they have to live in fear. And we as a society can address that. We've done it before, but it takes effort, money, and commitment. But it can be done.
That's a terrific job. What do you think of that idea?
I completely agree. I mean, we can talk about cases that happened here in Chicago. A young man's 8-year-old boy was executed behind their house. Nobody came forward. A young boy was executed.
But again, he's come up with a specific that would come through the Justice Department.
Absolutely.
That could be something that a president. What do you think of that idea, too?
But it is huge.
A great idea on the mm-hmm. table.
Well, it's a good idea, but at the same time, everybody, it's a myth that people are not telling. Police know what I'm talking about. A lot of people are telling. You just don't hear about it. You know, everybody's wearing wires out there. You know what I'm talking about.
I
mean, nowadays, you arrest 40 people, 38 of them are telling before they get to the police station. That's a big myth, Bruce. Seriously.
But why is no one charged?
Because it the
they're charged. They just may not be convicted because a lot of these people do get lawyers to represent them and end up beating the case.
I rarely ever hear a story about someone who's involved in a shooting in Chicago that makes the news where someone's been charged with a crime. I rarely ever hear that
story. Well, you had a very low homicide clearance rate, about 32-34% in Chicago right now. And I agree with you on that. But the reality is that people are telling. They are. I'm just have to be straight.
With all due respect to you, that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I'm not talking about if you arrest 30 people, 29 rat out last guy in. That's not helpful. That you're chasing your tail all the time.
Yes.
What the strike force was about, it was created by Bobby Kennedy, and it was because local law enforcement wasn't dealing with the mob. They weren't dealing with it in a systematic way. And what we did is we didn't arrest 5 guys and take 3 in the back room with rubber hoses and make them rat out the other guy. What we did is we built cases. It took years to build it, but you built it up slowly, slowly, slowly. You got all the evidence, and then you put everybody in jail. You don't have to make deals with 29 guys or put a guy on trial where everybody who's a witness against him is also a criminal who's just copping out, and the jury says, well, they're all criminals and I'm not going to convict this guy because he was the last guy.
But also you said the protective custody situation.
Protective custody.
This is a massive effort.
It's a massive effort. One of the things we did, the strike force did, is we had dedicated federal agents from all different agencies, not just the FBI, the IRS, Treasury, etc., and they came in. We were not part of the local law enforcement scene. We weren't part of that. We came in and we were independent. So even if people in New York, in Brooklyn, for instance, thought that half the cops were making phone calls to the mafia if they came in, and I wouldn't say it was half, but it was happening. Well, they didn't have to worry with us because we weren't part of that culture. We weren't part of that police culture. All I'm saying is this is just one idea. There's probably much better ideas out there that smarter people than me will have. But if we were serious about the genocide that's happening in this city every year, we have an Orlando every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
In Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing anything. We're doing the same things we did 5 years ago, and it's not going to have a different result.
Another idea, because, again, in the cases in Minnesota and Baton Rouge, the federal prosecutors or the feds, FBI is coming in to investigate. Special prosecutors coming in to look the Laquan McDonald. It takes the politics of a local community out of it. And maybe one of the reasons or ways in which to rebuild trust between the police departments and city administrations and the African-American communities is to have this third force come in, that it is representing the federal government. They come in. The local police are basically out of it. The politics are out of it. And the comparison that I would make is whenever there's a plane crash in the United States, the National Transportation Safety Board, this independent government agency, comes in. They investigate all plane crashes. There's no politics involved. They investigate the plane crashes. I'm calling for something that would be similar to that, which would be like a strike force from the Justice Department that would come in whenever there was a shooting involving an officer of a different race. It triggers, no pun intended, it results in that automatic response. So the local political leaders, they're away from it because the fingers may be turned back on them. The local police departments are out of it. It's something that happens automatically. It's an automatic review of every police shooting involving across or beyond racial bounds. 1-800-723-8029. Tell me whether you think that's a good idea or a lousy idea. 1-800-723-8029. We'll be back with calls when we come on back from Chicago.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to phone calls. Let's go to Richard, listening to us on Sirius XM Radio tonight in Birmingham, Alabama. Go ahead, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to add a little thing to your process,
yeah,
which would be that when you come down with a misdemeanor, in other words, like if it's an armed robbery or something that's in progress and the race of the officer is opposite, I don't think that should necessarily trigger the investigation. But if it's something like a traffic stop, in other words, if the initial encounter didn't necessarily warrant a weapons, for example, and you get shot, that would be something that I would say would trigger it. But I like the idea of triggering it and taking it completely out of the hands.
Yeah, because Stephanie made a point about why she didn't think it would work in Chicago, which was.
Well, part of it is we have a mayor who doesn't want to open up the process to another organization. So I think there's
my legislation that would take that all away from every. No mayor would be able to say that. In other words, this would be automatic. This would be Department of Justice. If this happens, if a plane crashes, a mayor can't say, well, we're not going to let the NTSB in to investigate this. You bring in the professionals. They know what to look for. They ask the question. What do you think of the idea?
I think it's a great idea. One, it helps to build trust and restore trust in a process that majority-minority communities don't already have, because the belief is that the Chicago Police Department or these police departments across the country just aren't going to respond in the way that they should.
Mm-hmm.
It also takes away, I think, police bias.
Right. What do you think?
The other thing I like the idea, but you got to remember that air traffic and air crashes, there's interstate commerce associated with that. So you might have a more difficult time. I like the idea, but implementing it might be a problem because
there will be a problem. But again, we're at a point, I think, in the country that we have got to do something, I think, dramatic. And frankly, we've had all kinds of these discussions about gun control, which unfortunately don't really go very far. I think there's some administrative things that could be done that would address the concern and the mistrust of the African American communities, take the politics out of the investigation, which frequently is part of the problem. And also, frankly, send a very strong signal to those who are engaged in law enforcement that, you know, if anything happens, they will be investigated. And they, by the way, should be. I know there's a lot of police officers who feel that, you know, that everybody is sort of pointing bad fingers at them right now. But that gets back to my point. If you know someone in your midst who is not doing their job properly, let someone know about it. Don't let another incident come up, because there will be other incidents that are going to happen. It's not going to change overnight. Patrick.
Just to address the caller's specific point, there is a very strong and well-established federal legal basis to investigate police killings. It's under the Civil Rights Act. That's the federal hook, so we don't need the interstate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
So legally, there's no obstacle to the feds coming in and setting up that sort of a system.
Okay, we're going to move to Michael in Monterey, California. Go ahead, you're on the air. Nice to have you with us tonight. Hello, Michael.
Yes.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
I think a good start in these cities, put a black cop and a white cop together. Get them out there. They'll work as a team. I think it'll help immensely. That's all I have to say.
Teal, comment on that.
That might be a good idea, have a black cop, white cop, and everybody just work together and help build the trust of the community back. That's very important.
Right.
And then, plus, we need a federal rescue plan, something higher level than the local jurisdiction.
No, I agree with that. Yes, and certainly, it works on every TV series, and maybe it'll work in reality. Mark, let's go to you in Portland, Oregon, listening to us on WUFO. Nice to hear from Oregon tonight. Go ahead.
Yes, hi there. Yeah, I did like the one earlier idea about putting your hands up, you know, when you get stopped. Just have everybody do that, everybody comply, and just, you know, don't resist, you know, show compliance and go from there, see how that statistics out. But, you know, there are, you know, a lot of people think that the cops are kind of out of control right now, you know. It seems to me I heard, and if this is true or not, that they've shot and killed 5 white people this week alone. Why are we not talking about that? You know, if they're so out of control, why don't we add those numbers to this argument?
Teal.
Well, you know, I don't like dealing in the race thing all the time. I love all people. But if white people are being shot by the police, the white community should actually start exposing that situation, okay? They start raising their voices up the same way we're raising our voices up, if that be the case.
Mark, thank you very much for your call, and I think it is important. And before we get through with this first segment, I want to take a moment to talk a little political stuff, because Newt Gingrich had some interesting things to say in the wake of the shootings last week, and this is what he had to say. It took me a long time and a number of people talking to me over the years to begin to get a sense of this. If you are a normal white American, the truth is you don't understand being black in America, and you instinctively underestimate the level of discrimination and the level of additional risk. We've got to rethink what it means to be an American and how we function together as an extended family, end of quote. Newt Gingrich. Your reaction to Newt's comment?
I completely agree with Newt. That
I think it just short answers. Yeah. What do you think of this, Amisha?
I thought it was a great comment. I shared it on Facebook and Twitter, but I also have the recognition that Newt Gingrich is 73 years old. So it's very interesting to me that somebody who lived through the civil rights movement and lived through all of those issues makes that statement today versus actually actively pursuing what he would have to actually make that statement have more volume. I think he knows he's running for a vice presidential seat, and he's doing whatever he can to get his name out there and to get some traction among the African-American community.
Deal? There may be a political reason why he said it, but what he said, wasn't it important, or was it important in your view?
It's very important, because he's taking a look at it from I'm not going to use the word empathy, but he's looking at it from a standpoint. You have to understand what people are dealing with, no matter who they may be. So even though it's a political statement, but the verdict is still out on Mr. Gingrich, okay?
Well, Patrick, what do you think of this comment by this
performance? I think it was a political statement, but it happens to be correct. So I don't want to give him too much or too little credit. What he said was true.
And he also went into, you know, what he witnessed as a child or young man growing up in Georgia, you know, the inequities that he saw and were overcome by the movement at that particular time. But again, in the next segment, I want to talk about a little more about the politics of it, a little bit more about how Hillary Clinton responded, how Donald Trump responded, and also how some of their surrogates on television today responded to it. And again, we also have a lot of callers on the line. I promise you, we will hear from you when we roll on as well. 1-800-723-8029 from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Saturdays at 4:30 and Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Back in Chicago, we're talking about the incidents of last week, not only the assassination of five police officers in Dallas, but also the shooting of two African-Americans in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and just outside Minneapolis, St. Paul. And Amisha, I want to talk to you. I want to sort of look at the politics, at least for a segment here, about the way in which Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump responded to that. They didn't jump out there quickly. They gave a few hours before they responded. But your overall take as to how the major politicians responded to this incident?
I think both major politicians responded well. I think I might have expected a little bit more from Donald Trump, to be honest, than what actually came out. I think that for Hillary, surrounding herself with black clergymen, the pictures are going all over Instagram and Twitter, standing for the community and making a, I would say, a generalized statement. It wasn't as in-depth as her speechwriters had originally wanted it to be. One, because again, this is still an ongoing case. But in addition to that, she has some work to do in the African American community, specifically younger African Americans. And I think that she is playing very well to that. In Donald Trump's case, he's offended almost every minority group in the country at some point. I think that right now.
But in this particular case, the way he responded, he talked about the police officers, talked about.
In this case, he gets an A because he really, I think that he stepped out. He stepped out in a way that was stronger than Hillary's.
Right. I think it's, you know, people were talking about, his, you know, Donald Trump's measured response. Now, how much of that is, you know, did he learn anything from his meeting on Capitol Hill the day before?
Well, it was scripted. It was scripted. It was delivered. It was different.
It was measured. It was not inflammatory. He didn't, you know.
Fritz is our director. Fritz, do we have that ready to play?
Yes, we do.
Okay. All right. Let's take a moment and listen to Donald Trump's response.
The shooting of the 12 police officers in Dallas, Texas, has shaken the soul of our nation. Just a few weeks ago, I met with many of the men and women in the Dallas police force during my visit to Texas. They're not just police officers. They're mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, sons and daughters. And they're all on my mind today. They're on everybody's mind. A brutal attack on our police force is an attack on our country and an attack on our families. We must stand in solidarity with law enforcement, which we must remember is the force between civilization and total chaos. Every American has the right to live in safety and peace. The deaths of Alton Sterling in Louisiana and Philando Castile in Minnesota also make clear how much more work we have to do to make every American feel that their safety is protected. Too many Americans are living in terrible poverty and violence. We need jobs, and we're going to produce those jobs. Racial divisions have gotten worse, not better. Too many headlines flash across our screens every day about the rising crime and rising death tolls in our cities. Now is the time for prayers, love, unity, and leadership. Our children deserve a better future than what we're making them live through today. But to get them there, we must work together and stand together. We will make America safe again.
Tio, your response to that comment?
I'm impressed with the Trump man, to be honest with you, and I'm a Democrat.
That's right.
I have to say that I'm impressed because he actually touched on some of the other, you know, acts of violence as well when he mentioned the young brother, Alton Sterling, because I never heard Donald Trump speak about police brutality or excessive force. So I commend him for speaking up the way he did, I must say.
Pat Cotter, your response? You're a Democrat, but your response?
Yeah, whoever wrote it did a good job.
Yeah. No, you're right.
And he read it beautifully.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think it represents who he is. Right. I don't think it's really his view. He's, as you say, he's been running for over a year. We've never heard him talk mm-hmm. about police violence before.
Right.
And so I think it's I'll never condemn somebody or criticize him for saying the right thing, but I don't think it should be read to be some sort of real representation of mm-hmm. his priorities. It's clearly not a priority.
Right.
He never mentioned it before.
I think we definitely have to taper with opportunism. But to Tio's point, I think that within that message, he also touched on some other things that are, to be honest, a lot of the reasons for the violence epidemic across minority communities and low-income communities. He talked about the economy and the jobs crisis.
Now, Hillary also talked about, you know, that white America's got to sort of, you know, understand what's going on there. Her comments were not too unlike what Newt Gingrich had to say, is that, you know, white America has some lessons to learn that not everyone may be treated the same way if they're stopped by the police department.
Well, and I think
what grade would you give Hillary?
You know, I felt like the big difference between the two is that Hillary talked about, you know, having kumbaya moments, and yet Donald Trump, he referenced those, but he took it one step further. Even Misha agrees that he said, you know, we've got to do more to make these communities better. We need to work on the things that are making these divides greater. So I felt like what he did a little better than Hillary was to actually take it one step further and say, you know, here are some action ideas, whereas Hillary's more about kumbaya.
Do you think, we're getting back to the politics of it, do you think Newt Gingrich's comment, which, again, in the last segment you sort of agreed, might have been a little political statement, or at least Misha believed that it was a political statement. I think a couple of people agreed with that. Did Newt Gingrich take a couple of steps closer to being the running mate? And does this incident and does this issue represent a unique opportunity for Donald Trump, if he had a running mate like Newt Gingrich, to lead the discussion that many people are calling from, and might be in a better position to lead that discussion than Hillary Clinton?
I do not think that Newt made himself closer. I think that when it comes down to picking a vice presidential candidate, Newt is an incredible strategist. He's a very smart man. He knows how to use language. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump isn't looking for that. I think he's looking for somebody that's going to help deliver a message, an idea, someone that's going to complement his personality more.
And who would that be?
I would not be surprised if it were Mike Pence, somebody a little bit more sedate, but dynamic, young, youthful.
I want to go back to you with the question I asked. Is that a unique opportunity for Newt Gingrich maybe to lead this discussion?
I think it's a unique opportunity, but at the same time, it's a play of words, because if it wasn't a political season, neither one of those guys will be talking about it at all. So that's where we're at right now. But Donald Trump, I must say, I believe that he's more equipped to deal with it straightforward. Hillary Clinton may, you know, she's been speaking out against, you know, excessive force and police brutality, you know, throughout, but she's like having a kumbaya moment, so to speak. But Donald Trump is just a strong force to be reckoned with. And I have to give him credit where it's due, because I believe that he would actually take the bull by the horns and deal with that situation. But I think he'd be more on the police side than the community side. I believe
disagree.
That.
I think, you know, Hillary is just as political as they come, and she's using these opportunities communities. And, you know, her attempts to woo different communities where she clearly doesn't have support is as political a move as you can get. And you know, her photo ops and having people stand with her.
I want to ask another question.
She's as political
as I want to ask the other question because we're talking a little bit about Veep politics. Does this issue and the importance to have this discussion, does it move Cory Booker, Senator Cory Booker, up the ladder as a potential running mate for Hillary Clinton?
Absolutely. I don't think that anybody could doubt that.
Everybody agree with that?
Totally agree. Yes.
Okay. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, calls for many segments. Bye.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Come on back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Let's go to Lauren listening to us in El Paso, Texas on KTSM. Go ahead, yes. Lauren.
Yes, Bruce. The people love your show because maybe you're the most objective man on the air.
Thank you.
We thought that we were headed for post-racial America when we elected Obama, and I was trying to pinpoint the point in time when the actual escalation started. And it seems to me that it began with when Henry Louis Gates Jr. in Cambridge hollered racist at the police, and then Obama came out and said the police acted stupidly. Wasn't that the real inception of this? Didn't the dominoes start falling after that, or am I completely...
I think some of the dominoes might have fallen. And I think if you're talking about the dominoes where you think race relations, you know, went south, I personally think, and we've talked about it for almost 7 years on this program, I think where things went bad for the president in race relations was what was happening in his own hometown in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of young black men have been killed in Chicago on Barack Obama's watch. He did not, in my view, properly use the bully pulpit to do something that was happening in his own hometown. Now, his rhetoric recently, by the way, his rhetoric as far as Dallas is concerned, I have no criticism for what the president had to say at all. I think the president's heart is in the right place. But a lot was happening in his hometown, and he didn't do, in my view, he didn't use the power of the bully pulpit to affect the lives of people living on the south and west sides of Chicago. And I want to get our African American guests to respond to that. They don't have to agree with me. They can disagree, whatever you want. Your response to whether or not Barack Obama could have done more in 7 years to reduce the crime rate, the murder rate in Chicago.
I think that what Barack Obama could have done in the past 7 years was greatly tapered by and continues to be tapered by the composition of Congress, first and foremost. In addition to that, it is not the president's responsibility to heal a city. That is the responsibility of the mayor and the state of Illinois, who have both consistently failed. And I think that if we are really taking a strong look at Chicago and we're looking at this state and we're looking at a lot of the issues within the African-American community, but also the issues of economic and as well as housing discrimination, we have to really take a look at those who are in leadership now.
Isn't it the responsibility of the president to heal America? And how can you heal America if you're not healing your own hometown?
Well, you know, you're talking about the president of the United States who's dealing with a crisis over in Afghanistan, Iraq. You know, you got different things going on across the world.
Right.
Gun control is on the agenda. So the reality is that, once again, and now, Bruce, when you have me on your show, you know I always tell the truth. You're not going to stop a killing unless you know the killer and you have a relationship with that killer, where that person will listen to you at that moment in time in his or her life. That's not the responsibility of the president. He can only do so much. Yes, he could have probably stepped up a lot more, but therefore he has a whole country to worry about. He has to deal with natural disasters. He has to deal with obstructionists down there in Congress, like the young lady was talking about. So we have a lot of – so we can't put it all on the president.
You don't believe there isn't anything that President Obama could have said over the last 7 years that would have sent a signal to – young black men and everyone, raise your hands up if the police say stop. Be compliant. The Department of Justice, which I will head, and my attorney generals, we will look and we will investigate every indiscretion against every African American. But you know what? You folks, meaning blacks, you have to help us. And you help us by putting your hands up if a police officer tells you to do so. Could the president not be that dramatic and say something?
Well,
and are you saying that no young African Americans would listen to Barack Obama?
I'm saying you got two different worlds out here. You got the rich, the middle class, and the people dealing with poverty every day. A lot of people may not listen to him saying that, for sure. I mean, because you can't just look at Chicago. Baltimore has a high homicide rate, okay? St. Louis, Memphis. You know, you got to look across the United States. It's not just about Chicago.
The president, when he speaks, everybody hears him. My point is there an element of the African-American community, and I'm going to use the term that maybe don't like, those that are criminally inclined.
Right.
Does the president not have any impact at all over the criminally inclined?
Not at all, because when you're out here dealing, I'm not taking up for nobody either. When you broke out here trying to survive day to day, you're not going to listen to nobody. You're trying to get some money in your pocket, period.
Patrick Cotter.
Yeah. You know,
am I living in a Pollyanna world?
Yeah, you are, actually.
Oh, that's good. Well, tell me that. That's good.
I think I just did. No, here, the caller makes an interesting concept. It raises this interesting concept that somehow Barack Obama promised that if we elected him, it would be a post-racial America. Mm-hmm. He actually never did that.
No, the media did.
The media did. I don't think that just because you happen to be black, you have a special obligation to make sure that all black people who are breaking the law will stop breaking the law any more than when Kennedy was elected. He was supposed to stop all the Catholics from breaking the law. I think the president, as was pointed out, has a lot of other issues. Crime is usually a local issue. That's how we set it up in this country. The other thing is the idea, trying to find the moment, you know, that the Louis Gates moment somehow tipped the first domino. If you ignore the first 300 years of the history of this country, we have never had good race relations in this country. We have gone in the 20s, people were being lynched. Okay, so the idea that somehow things are now worse than they ever were is crazy. Beyond that, I would just point out, if we're going to talk about presidents using the bully pulpit, fine. What did Bush say about gang crime? What did he say about guns and crime in the cities? What did any of the presidents before Obama do? They didn't. And the crime rates were higher then.
Right.
The crime rate today is at a 40-year low in this nation. And the other thing I would just point out is that most of the crime in this country, most of the violent crime in this country is carried out by white people. It is not carried out by African Americans.
Right.
And yet we don't have discussions about why aren't, you know, Donald Trump or some other white politician using their bully pulpit to get all these white guys to stop this terrible crime they're doing. We treat Obama differently because he's black. We expect him to be some sort of, and this is the term I'm sure we've all heard about, the magic Negro, who can come in and he has this magic power and he can just make everything good. It's usually Morgan Freeman. Is usually the Negro, and it used to be Sidney Poitier, okay?
Yeah.
But now it's Morgan Freeman. But the point is that he's a politician. I think he's a good politician. I think he's done a good job. But this idea that somehow all race relations in this country fall on him just because his skin happens to be black is, I think, unfair, and I think it should stop.
That's good.
What about the crime in his hometown, though? Is that
when he's the mayor? When he's the mayor, then it's on his shoulders. And if he doesn't do something about it, I'll give him a hard time. But I think the point was made very well. He's unfortunately he was fighting when he came in the biggest recession since the Great Depression, two wars. He's got the whole world is constantly exploding around him. The idea that he's supposed to deal with the crime rate on the south and west sides of Chicago, with all due respect, it's just not fair.
I want to ask you a question because your background is a federal prosecutor in Brooklyn. It's a little sensitive question, but I'm going to ask you if you feel comfortable discussing it. There have been stories written that Donald Trump, being a real estate developer in New York, had close associations with members of organized crime or did some business with them. There's been stories written about it over the last 7 months. There'll probably be more in the next 3 months. As someone who worked in that office, do you have any opinion at all about that relationship, if any ever existed?
No, I do not. And here's why. What happens in a federal investigation until there is an indictment is secret, and it should be secret. And it's secret to protect the innocent. It's secret to protect even the guilty who you don't have enough evidence to go against. The idea is the fact that someone may have been investigated, that there were rumors, that there were things looked into, doesn't mean anybody's done anything wrong or broken the law, and it would be absolutely inappropriate for anybody, even an old, aging ex-Fed, to make any kind of comment about rumors like that and what we looked into. What we should talk about, what we can talk about, is what we brought into a courtroom. What we said, here it is. This is what we think happened.
During,
and we never did that with him.
During the news break, you were telling those around the table this evening about your life as a young federal prosecutor and what you had to do being a federal prosecutor going after the mob in Brooklyn. Share some of those stories with you. I mean, it's a fascinating description of one man's life and trying to be on the right side of the law.
Well, I was just telling the story that there were certain neighborhoods in Brooklyn which were dominated by organized crime. And I lived in one when I first moved to Brooklyn, and I ended up spending 14 years there. And when I moved into that neighborhood, I wouldn't tell anybody what I did for a living because it just didn't seem like a good idea. I told everybody I sold insurance. And all my neighbors thought I was a very bad insurance salesman because I didn't have a car. I wore old suits, cheap suits, because that's what you can afford when you're a Fed. But the fact of the matter is those areas of Brooklyn and Queens and even some parts of Manhattan that were so dominated by the mob were places where the population, most of them, had nothing to do with the day-to-day workings of organized crime. Yet they were so intimidated and indeed, to a certain degree, sympathetic to organized crime. And they had family and relatives, brothers, sisters, uncles who were involved that they would never, ever say anything. And I'll leave you one final story. When I was living in Brooklyn and I applied for my job as a Fed, one day I came home and my landlady, who was this lovely old Italian lady, she came running up to my room and she says, "Hey, Mr. Cotter. There were two Feds here today, and they were asking about you. But don't worry. I told them I didn't know who you were." And it turns out it was a background check, and they were just trying to confirm my address.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. The other big story last week was the decision by the FBI that they would not press charges or indict Hillary Clinton. And I guess the good news was, legally, Hillary Clinton is not going to be indicted. But the blistering sort of public relations indictment that the FBI Director James Comey delivered was somewhat devastating. And I want to ask our Republican, did James Comey do a favor for the Republicans by handling that situation the way he handled it?
He did. I like to sort of describe that, unlike Solomon, he actually did split the baby. And he gave Hillary a break by not being, but he also gave the the Republicans a lot of great information. There's nothing that Hillary can take away from his statements or his findings that she could use in any political ad.
Amisha Cross, I want to get your reaction. The same question.
Were
you ecstatic when you heard what he had to say?
No. I was going into it because I thought this was going to be amazing. And then I watched it live and really wanted to cry, because it seemed as though either he lost every talking point he had, or he forgot that Hillary Clinton is running for president. And the fact that she already has some disseminating levels of public support regarding how people view her and her level of honesty. So to have him come out and make the type of statements that he did, to somewhat try to admonish her, but on that same token, kind of allude to the fact that she knew more than she actually let on that she knew, it was hard to watch, but it also showcased a man who I think honestly got a lot of questions that he couldn't answer.
He saved her candidacy, and yet he handed the Republicans a bill of particulars that are devastating. Patrick Cotter, a former federal prosecutor, your reaction to what Comey did and how he did it?
Well, I think the first thing needs to be said is it's extremely unique. I've never heard of something like this in my life. First of all, the FBI doesn't decide who gets charged with a crime. Prosecutors do. Second of all, when you don't charge somebody with a crime, as I mentioned earlier in a different context, it is against the rules to come out and make statements about them, because, of course, there's never any chance for them to rebut them or fight them. You're supposed to say either I'm charging you and here's the indictment and we'll have a trial and you will see if it's true or not, or you say I'm not indicting you, goodbye. As a matter of fact, usually they don't even tell us when they don't indict us. It's just they never call you back. And then you wait 5 years and the statute of limitations runs and it's over. So it was an extraordinary event. I will say, though, that where I differ, I think, from many people in the public is I look at this as a lawyer and a federal prosecutor. And he was right. He was right. If you look at our guidelines, if you look at the evidence, this case never would be indicted. It would never be indicted. Carelessness is not criminality. Stupidity is not criminality. Arrogance is not criminality. She was careless.
Extremely careless.
Extremely careless. She was stupid. And I think there was a certain amount of arrogance there. But there was no prosecutor in their right mind who would have indicted that case. It didn't deserve to be indicted. There wasn't proof of intent. She never intended to violate her trust, because she stupidly and arrogantly and extremely carelessly believed that her email was secure. She was wrong, but that's not a crime.
To you, what's your reaction? And I want to kind of put it in context, as I said to Amisha. I mean, on one hand, the good news was she's not going to be indicted. She's not going to go to jail. And yet he saved her. He moved her to the Democratic convention in Philadelphia. And he basically forces the Democratic Party to nominate her, a very flawed candidate.
Well, yeah, Hillary was definitely careless in her regards to how she sent classified information through her personal email. So I think he gave a polished response, and he helped out, without a doubt. Hillary, I don't think she'll never make a mistake like that again. All due respect to Hillary Clinton, but it was careless, and it shows poor judgment, especially for somebody running for president of the United States, because that means that you might get laxed again, and you might make another mistake like that, which could be really detrimental.
poor judgment, poor judgment, extremely careless, may have the information may have been shared with enemies of the country.
No, there's no evidence of that.
Stop.
He said, right. Stop. It's possible, but they didn't find it.
Anything is possible. There's no evidence of it. We're talking about the law.
No, I didn't say
that. There's no evidence that there was any dissemination. And that's important. It's important legally. It's important politically.
No, there wasn't the dissemination, but again, he raised the possibility that someone could have done that.
Of course, anything is possible, but that's not evidence. This guy just finished – the FBI just finished what I have to believe was an extremely thorough investigation.
Okay.
If there had been one shred of evidence, we'd have heard about it. So there wasn't. The other thing I just want to point out is that
– but it did show that she had lied on a couple of pages or missed
it. No, he didn't say that. He didn't say she lied. He said that, but people say that. Let me point something out.
Her own words. The contradiction of what she said and what he said.
Being mistaken is not the same thing as lying, Bruce.
Okay.
And that's a big difference. And you don't indict. Wait. Being mistaken is not the same thing as lying, and you don't indict people for being mistaken. Look, the other thing that nobody is saying that is important to say, one of the reasons this case wasn't tried that Mr. Comey said is he looked at all the precedent. Right. No case like this had ever been prosecuted criminally. No case. And one of the reasons is that you could never get a conviction. One of the reasons you couldn't get a conviction is that the last three Secretary of States have done the same thing. Hundreds of high-ranking government officials in all different departments in the federal government have done the same thing. That's not a defense, but it is to say – that the idea that this is somehow some huge issue, I think is false. And I would also just end with this point. I have a very hard time trying to imagine in my mind the person in America who at this point in the campaign is going to say, wow, she screwed up on the emails, I'm voting Trump. I don't think it changes one vote. It's not going to change one vote. It's all very interesting to us, but I don't think it changes the election.
Well, I agree with that.
And it's interesting because without putting words in Comey's mouth, one of the things that I think he was struggling in trying to explain is that there was all this talk, the legalese talk about what intent meant and whether and these ideas of standards of carelessness, negligence, gross negligence, willfulness and whatever. Okay, and that blurs everybody. But one of the things that he did do and compared her with other cases is that he didn't use the word motive, but motive. In a lot of those other cases, they were going to sell those secrets. They were using them to undermine, you know, the purpose for which they were doing these things is very different.
The cases her purpose, that were prosecuted.
Right. Her purpose was pure personal convenience and to some sense an arrogance and not willing to be bothered by the rules. Mm-hmm. Now, but on the other hand, what he has done is he has flushed out and confirmed for many what a lot of Republicans are saying about her is that she does think she's above the law. She thinks she has a different set of rules. She does have a sense of arrogance. She, you know, and that what he's done is handed to the Republicans, a final statement on that.
But do you agree with Patrick that it reinforces?
I think that there are. I will disagree with Patrick. I've heard people, Republicans, say, you know what? After this, I think I will vote for Trump. There were a lot of Republicans on the fence, and I've heard Republicans saying that after this, they will vote for
Trump.
But
Republicans were never going to vote for Hillary to begin with.
They were going to stay home.
So
we're talking
about I know some that were going to vote for Hillary, maybe we'll stay home, or we're going to stay home, are now voting for Trump.
Is the issues of what we discussed in the first hour, race relations, police-community relations, do the story of jobs, the story of protecting the country from terrorists, does that take the email issue and put it to the side? In other words, the issue becomes
absolutely
other issues. And again, they're going to the people who like Hillary or hate Hillary, you're not going to change many of them. They, you know, those that hate her think she's a liar. They think all kinds of things.
I don't think it does push them to the side. I think if done properly by Donald Trump is that he needs to associate those issues and her ability to act with good judgment on them with examples like not only the emails. He's got to remind people that this email thing began because of what happened in Benghazi in the first place and what went on with the emails and her willingness to mislead about what she knew about those emails and what she was doing with them is correlates to her story, her willingness to lie about a video being the reason for Benghazi.
Also,
we haven't
even gotten into the Clinton Foundation, but I, right. I want to get back to something in a short period of time.
Yes.
You said during the break, when we were talking about Donald Trump before, you said there are people that you know who are in Black Lives Matter who are going to support Donald Trump.
Yes. So there were some comments about how black men are not necessarily as strong in terms of a base for Hillary Clinton. And I've seen that. There are a lot of black men who do not view her as someone who actually represents them. There are a lot of black men who don't think that she has been as hard or as strong when she's talking about economics and the reality that it is for the black community as Donald Trump has been. And I think that from my own perspective and talking to black men who I know are in Black Lives Matter marching on a regular basis, who've come out and said they're definitely not going to support Hillary. They are going to vote Donald Trump. I find that very interesting, but that's something that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Have you picked that up?
Well, I haven't picked it up that much myself, but I believe it's out there because, you know, you got to think about it. Hillary is about embarking on making history, become the first female president of the United States, of the free world, so to speak. So it's difficult, but I do believe that Hillary, she knew better. She's been around a long time, so making a careless mistake like she made, she got a pat on the back, basically. So we wish her the best, but I haven't heard that from the African-American community myself in regards to Hillary as of yet, not me.
Do you think, Patrick, do you think within the circles that you travel, is there enthusiasm for Hillary, or are there some Bernie Sanders supporters that you know that are somewhat reluctant, even though Bernie Sanders is scheduled to endorse her next week?
Well, what I'll say about Hillary is I think she's extremely fortunate in her opponent. I have not noted a lot of enthusiasm for Clinton, but I will say that most of the Democrats I know are not having a real problem voting for her because the alternative is just unthinkable. Right. So that's where it's at.
Back with more calls, 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. Let's go to Bernardo, listening to us in El Paso, Texas on KTSM. Go ahead, Bernardo.
Yes, sir. The only question I have is, as a person that holds a security clearance, you know, she may not have done something illegally, but, you know, who decides if she's able to keep her security clearance or if she's able to get another one? Because if I did half the stuff she did, at a minimum, I would have lost my security clearance.
Well, if she's – Bernardo, a point is, if she's elected president of the United States, she will get it. But I thought one of the most interesting comments of the week was from the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who suggested that if she is the Democratic nominee, which she is likely to be – he believes she should not get the traditional security clearance or security briefing that presidential candidates get. What does everybody think of that idea?
I think that's completely ridiculous. And he did it to incite the base. At the end of the day, and I think that it was brought up earlier, there have been in three
He's
previous administrations
the guy that's
someone
inciting
who made
the
these
base,
exact
though.
Types of exact types of comments. She didn't do something out of the box or original in this instance. And I think that she's definitely learned her lesson. But no, if you're
Stephanie, what about it?
I think this is where, you know, the sort of common sense thing is she is running for president. She is running for the highest office. Nobody's going to take away her security clearance of that. And I don't think
Why
it's, I don't think it's a
Ryan
good idea to
that?
Do it. I think he's trying to drive home the point and sort of second what Comey said in his own report is this not to say that she shouldn't face some sort of sanction, that what she did isn't somehow punishable and inappropriate. And I think – but I think let's be practical here. I don't know why Paul Ryan would say it except to just remind people that what she did is serious.
For one day, the Republican Party was unified on an issue.
Well, you know, with Donald Trump's emotional outburst, do you think he's going to hold classified information? Let's be straight up here. Now, the bottom line, Paul Ryan said that because he's a Republican. That's the only reason he said it. Okay, I'm just
well.
Honest.
No, but he said it because the FBI director right. had said exactly. before
I understand,
that.
Well, I understand that.
Maybe she had not handled it.
But no, anyway, he can criticize Hillary. He's going right. to criticize.
No, counselor,
there is a legal reason why Comey yeah. said that in his statement, and also in the U.S. Attorney manual, which lays out the reasons why you do or don't prosecute somebody. One of the mm-hmm. considerations is if there are administrative sanctions available to address the conduct, such that a criminal prosecution is not necessary. Then that is a reason, another reason not to indict. So he's listing all the reasons why he's not going to indict, and he makes reference to the administrative sanctions that are available. That's right out of the book. So every federal prosecutor in the country heard it one way. Everybody else heard it another way. I get that. But to a lawyer, I understand why he's saying that. But I don't think he's really suggesting that they take away her briefings.
You said at the beginning, however, that you had never seen anything quite like this.
Right.
Did it disturb you that you were watching what you were watching, or what was your personal reaction?
Well, I will tell you, I was very torn because on the one hand, if it would have been anybody else but somebody running for president, I would have thought it was outrageously inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Outrageously inappropriate. But having said that, she's running for president. And I think that the whole country was going to want an explanation for why they were recommending no prosecution. So I think he had to say something. I think he had to give an explanation. I think that's a political reality, but I hope it's a one-time event. I hope this doesn't become the norm now where they come out with the government makes statements saying, well, we don't have enough evidence to charge you with a crime, but we think you're a horrible person.
And for those conspiracy theorists who may be listening to the broadcast this evening, who may see a link between what Comey said and what the attorney general may or may not have said on a tarmac in Phoenix with Bill Clinton, your reaction when you heard that Bill Clinton had done what he did?
Incredibly stupid. And I frankly, I'm not even that surprised about Bill because that's kind of what Bill does. I know Loretta Lynch. We worked together in Brooklyn. Loretta Lynch is as smart as anybody I've ever known in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And how she could be just have such a brain spasm to meet with the husband of somebody that she's investigating is just beyond me. And it was a terrible mistake.
Does it underscore what Stephanie said is that maybe even in your opinion that the Clintons seem to be above the law?
Here's what I'll tell you. I haven't spent a lot of time in Washington, but I over my years as a federal prosecutor, I had to deal with them all the time, and I had to go down there regularly and fight with them to try and get them to leave me alone so I could
them
do my
meaning?
Job. Washington.
Okay.
People in Washington. Yes, okay. People in Washington.
Inside the Beltway.
Inside the Beltway. That's right. And let me tell you this. If arrogance was a disqualifier for being in Washington, it would be a ghost town. Everybody is arrogant down there. It seems to be in the water. Everybody in government is arrogant. Do I think the Clintons are arrogant? Yeah. They've been there a long time. And I think everybody else who's down there just about – obviously, I'm painting with a broad brush. But the arrogance of dealing with people in the federal government, anybody who's ever had to do it, it's enormous. I think they're arrogant, sure. So does everybody else down there.
Short amount of time left. I want to go back to the vice presidential pick. By the time we get together next week, we will probably know who Donald Trump picks. You had some comments about Newt Gingrich. Does Newt Gingrich, with the issues he's had with his wives, does that just reinforce a negative for that ticket?
Well, that would be interesting because we'd have a president and a VP candidates with multiple wives, both of them. However, I don't think that Newt brings the extra pizzazz, the extra confidence to the ticket. He's not necessarily the most beloved Republican either. I don't think he's going to bridge the independent gap.
Does he help conservatives? Or is that a mixed bag?
No, I think it's a mixed bag. I think Mike Pence does, though.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's, you know, and he, Mike Pence can bring, Mike Pence is also a governor who can hammer down the economic successes.
What would you think
Trump is going to run on?
An idea that I would like to float, because we're going off the air, is you select a vice presidential running mate. And the other thing that Donald Trump does, because he's been criticized, that who he's going to surround himself with, is you name a Secretary of State, maybe Newt Gingrich, yes, an Attorney General, Chris Christie, a head of HHS, you know, or maybe, you know, Ben Carson, or maybe a Secretary of Defense, you know, General Flynn. You come up with the top three or four cabinet members so that people know from the get-go that he's surrounding himself with people, and people can vote up or down on it and may force Hillary Clinton to do the same thing. Anyway, we'll talk about it probably not next week. We'll be back next week. It'll be live from Cleveland. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to our guests this evening for being with us. And also our thanks to Colin Bobbitt and Dan Dorfman and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger. And I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Saturdays at 4:30 and Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Miss Lewinsky, I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.